The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
As all of you supporters here today know, the Free Library provides essential services throughout the year to hundreds of thousands of individuals throughout the Philadelphia area. And we also know that these services are especially critical during these stressful economic times. You also know that last week we finally celebrated the passage of state legislation that will help to ensure that our 54 libraries around the region remain open and continue to serve. Continue to serve the job seekers who increasingly depend on our free computers and our internet service to access and search for jobs, as well as to serve the small business owners and the entrepreneurs who are so important to our region's economy. And we will find the money somehow to fund this legislation. The Free Library, as you know, also serves the research and reference that is ongoing on the health care for the public, providing information not only about the national health care debate, but also practical information and access to online sources for people who are trying to make informed choices about their own health care, and we know how difficult that can be. So we are particularly happy today to add additional information to those choices that people are making with our speaker, Dr. Howard Dean, who recently published an important resource on the current health care debate, a book that's been hailed as the single best vehicle for understanding health care reform. Dr. Dean is no stranger to all of us. His credentials span both the medical and the political arenas, well positioning him to analyze the current debate. You will remember that he began his career as a physician in the state of Vermont, and that he later transitioned into public service. He was the governor of Vermont for 12 years. And under his leadership, that state expanded its universal health care program for children and for pregnant women. It balanced its budget and reduced income taxes. Not a bad record. Dr. Dean spearheaded innovative fundraising strategies during a run for president, and his time as chairman of the Democratic National Committee earned him widespread credit for reviving the Democratic Party after the 2004 presidential election and gave rise to some pretty interesting discussions with people across the country. I know from personal experience, but that for another time. His new book, Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Healthcare Reform, argues that the key to healthcare reform is to offer citizens the option to participate in a public health insurance program. There you go. Called a searing indictment of private insurers who put profits ahead of care by Publishers Weekly, Dr. Dean's book explores President Obama's health care plan, how other countries deal with health care, special interests that stand in the way of progress, and how health care reform will help American businesses flourish. Without any further introduction, it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Howard Dean. I think you've got a friendly audience.
I'm going to cause trouble for you.
That's okay. I can take it.
Let me thank all of you for coming. Let me thank Leslie Ann for her kind introduction. And I do cause trouble wherever I go. I am a huge fan of hers, and wouldn't she make a great governor of the state of Pennsylvania? First woman governor to add to your long list of firsts. Let me, what I'd like to do, and I usually can't quite confine myself as much as I should, my goal is to talk about the book for 10 minutes or maybe 15 and then open it up to questions. We have an hour for this, and then I'm going to obviously sign books. I always find that the questions and the audience participation is a lot more fun and bring things up to, that folks haven't thought of, and so let's try to do that. I wrote the book because I thought it was important to translate what I think is probably the most complex public policy issue on the domestic front into plain English. It is, it's full of acronyms, and the financing is very complicated. It's kind of a healthcare system that's not really a system. And I wanted to put it in plain English. And there's two people on the front of the book, Igor Volsky and Faz Shakir, who started out as research assistants and ended up as co-authors. They did so much work, I thought they were great. These are two young guys. One of them is only about 25. And they work for the Center for American Progress. They're real. One of them writes something called The Wonk Room. And if you're a wonk on healthcare, you should go look it up because it's got this stuff, but it's got all the numbers and the acronyms and everything else. But I wanted to thank them for all their extraordinary help. The book is a lot of fun. It's got a section on myths, on the 12 or 13 myths that the hate radio hosts talk about when they talk about the healthcare plan. Even though, as smart as we all are writing this book, even we didn't imagine that they would come up with the death panel, so there's no refutation to the death panel myth. There is a section in there on what other countries do, which is worth reading because this can be done. In fact, every other Western democracy, industrialized democracy, has this, has universal health care, and they do it in different ways. There's a couple of sections on what you can do to make this happen. Now, here we are in Philadelphia, where most of your congresspeople are going to support this and support the public option. But folks need a boost, and there's all kinds of things that you can do listed in the book, websites you can go to, how you can be active in the debate, and how you can make this happen. The central part of the book, which is the part I want to spend a little bit of time on before we go to questions, is that if you don't have a public option, this is not worth doing. And here's why. This is not a doctrinaire. I'm not a single-payer person, although I'm not against a single-payer. I don't really care how we do this as long as we do it, but it has to be done right. And here's what you have to understand about the health care that we have in this country. First of all, the brilliance of Obama's bill, and I think it is a brilliant bill, is that he understands that you have to get to where we're going by starting where we are. And the reason the Europeans have universal systems that are mostly based on government participation is because in the war their health care systems were destroyed. Oddly enough, the person who did the most to establish the National Health Service in Britain was the second most conservative prime minister in the last century, Winston Churchill, the first, of course, being Maggie Thatcher, who didn't like the NHS at all. And the reason that he was called upon to do this in his brief prime ministership after the war, before he was kicked out, is because the healthcare system was really badly damaged in the war, and they kind of commandeered all the private hospitals and doctors' practices and got them all to work together to make sure that everybody had adequate healthcare during the war. And afterwards, the public liked it so much that essentially, there was the beginnings, of course, of the NHS before the war, but that really kind of cemented where they were going to be. And that's a similar kinds of histories happened across the continent. In this country, the opposite happened. Why? Because we got attacked twice, once in the Aleutian Islands and once in Hawaii. Our problem was we were printing money like crazy in order to finance the war effort. And so inflation was a real problem. So there were wage and price controls, particularly in the immediate post-war period, to try to keep our ability to finance making all the war material. And so the only way that people could give raises to their hardworking employees and keep the ones they really wanted was to give great fringe benefits, because they weren't allowed to raise wages. And the great fringe benefits turned out to be health care. That's how we ended up with an employer-based system. Now, there are a lot of things we're going to talk about in the question period, but I want to focus just on the public option for a minute. I'm a capitalist. I'm an American, right? Capitalism works great, except at least the free market system works great, except in two areas that I know of. One is defense, and the number of Iraq contractors that charge three times as much as we were paying our troops to do the same job is a pretty good example of how free market doesn't work in defense of the United States. Not only that, we'll get into that later. I don't know if I get sidetracked on that one. The other area is health care. The free market does not work in healthcare. All these people who talk about free market solutions to healthcare either have socialized healthcare themselves, i.e., the Congress of the United States, or don't know anything about it. And here's why. If you want to go out and buy a house or a car or something like that, you look around, you see what's available, you look at your budget. Maybe your eyes are a little bigger than your budget. You try to slim down. Maybe you even have to put off the purchase for a year or two and continue to rent or you take public transit or whatever. But you're in the driver's seat. You're making the decision. But in the healthcare system, it doesn't work that way. I'm the doctor. You come to me, and instead of you're making the decision, I tell you what you want and what you get, and then we send the bill to a third party. And furthermore, the sicker you are, the more I get paid. The more stuff I do to you, whether you need it or not, the more I get paid. This is insane. There is no intersection of a supply and demand curve. And it gets worse than that. I once, as you know, I did a lot of impolitic things when I was running in Iowa. And I once was on a hospital tour in a western city in Iowa. And they were touring me in the hospital. And they were so proud that they were going to get a new cardiac catheterization lab, which is, for those who don't know what that is, it's a very expensive diagnostic laboratory for heart problems. And they were so pleased with themselves, and they were working so hard to get it, and they were giving me the tour of the hospital. I said, well, is there another hospital in town? This is not a big town. I said, yeah, oh, there's one 4 blocks down. I said, do they have a catheterization lab? Oh, yeah, they do. And I said, well, if I were the governor, I wouldn't give you one. Well, it wasn't very politic, but it was the truth. Because in the cars or houses, the more there are in the market, the lower prices. But in medicine, the more stuff you, more facilities you have, the higher the price goes because you got to fill them up and you got to pay for them. So anybody thinks that we're going to solve this in the free market system is wrong. And furthermore, if you want to look at efficiency in capitalism, You look at people's bottom line, how much money they make. A company that makes a lot of money and gives good service is a really efficient company and contributing to the efficiency of American enterprise. But in health insurance, the more money you make, the less efficient you are. And what do I mean by that? Medicare, for example, takes 4 cents out of every premium and tax dollar that you pay in and uses that for administration. 96 cents of every dollar that goes into Medicare is spent on health care. But in the private sector, about 20% of every dollar goes into something other than health care. And the more their return on equity is for their shareholders, the less that goes into health care. So the more money they make, the more they take out of your premiums and put in something other than health care. This system that we have is insane. And it is not a wonder that we pay 70% more than the next most expensive countries, and yet our indices are 37th in the country, in the world, compared to the other countries. That is why you need a public option. We're not asking for a single payer. We're not asking to tell the American people that they ought to leave something they like. And by the way, most people like their private insurance. Most people do. There are 80% roughly of the people in America have insurance, and of that, 80% thinks their insurance is pretty good. They think it may be a little expensive, but they think it's pretty good. So what Obama's genius is, instead of saying to people, well, you're going to change something that you like into something that is necessary for you, and 65 beats 35 every time in a democracy, what he has said, we're going to give you a choice. If you want something different, you can finally have it. If you want to be in a system that can't deny you health care, that doesn't kick you off health care if you get sick, where you can take the health care insurance and go any place in the country with it, where you can have it if you have a job and if you lose your job, you still have it, i.e. Medicare. If you want something like that, you can now have it. But if you like what you have, you can keep it. This debate should not be framed around things like the public option. It ought to be framed around the question of who makes the choice. What the Republican position is, we will make that choice for you. Politicians, insurance companies, employers, bureaucrats, we will make that choice for the American people. What the Obama position is, you get to make the choice. You will decide what's best for your family. You want to be in a single payer? We have one. Medicare has been in existence for 45 years in this country. It's a single payer, a government-run system. I get such a kick out of these people who hate the health care reform and say, but keep the government's hands off my Medicare. I love it. So if you like what you have, you can keep it. But if you want something different, we will allow you to get into something different. And furthermore, we'll subsidize your choice. What Obama's plan says, if you don't have much money, or you work for a small business or somebody that doesn't give insurance, we will, through savings and through increased taxes, we will take that money and we will help modest income people buy the insurance of their choice, whether it is public insurance or whether it is private insurance. This is about who chooses. It is not about the merits of these health care plans. I think the American people will make a much wiser choice than all the people who have been doing this for the last 30 years. If you don't have a – the reason I take the position that if you don't have a public option, don't do this, is there are some good things in the bill. There's insurance reform. 15 years ago, we did a lot of the stuff in this bill in Vermont. In fact, we even had a public option, although we didn't call it that at the time. 15 years ago, we forced all our insurance companies to take everybody without actuarial or physical examinations. The only way you can be turned down for insurance in my state is if you don't pay the bills. And we forced the insurance companies to charge everybody roughly the same. In Vermont, the sickest patient that you insure cannot be charged more than 20% above what you charge the very healthiest low-risk patient. That's community rating. Of course, Medicare has no community rating whatsoever. I mean, it has 100% community rating. There's no difference in what you charge, whether somebody's sick or not. So it's really, we make them, if the insurance companies are going to come into Vermont, we make them actually sell insurance, which is pooled risk, not just kick the people off to make as much money as they can. And you know what? Insurance companies left when we did it. It was the best thing that ever happened to us. We got rid of all the people who were taking 20 and 30 and 40% out and putting it in their pocket, and we now have, for the most part, reasonable insurance companies, with some exceptions, because the whole business has gotten pretty awful in the last 15 years. And the public option, which we didn't really call at the time, but it's true, with Bill Clinton's help, we had a waiver for Medicare. So if you make less than $66,000 a year in Vermont, you can pay $480 to the state government, and we'll put you on Medicaid, put all your kids in the family on Medicaid who are under 18 years old. And now we had to raise rates for pediatricians. You can't expect pediatricians to have an 80% Medicaid practice and be able to stay in business. But that's a public option. 99% of the kids in our state who are under 18 years old either have insurance or are eligible for it. 99%, and that's been going on for 15 years. This stuff works, and it works because we let the families make the choice of how they wanted their kids cared for. If we can do that in a small, middle-income state like Vermont, we can do that in the greatest, richest country on the face of the earth. So keep the insurance. By all means, do the insurance reforms. We did it 15 years ago. We know it works well. But don't pretend that health care reform without a public option is health care reform. It isn't. It's shoveling $60 billion a year into the system that has screwed us up over the last 30 years, and that is nuts. It is so Washington to think that you're going to do the same thing for the 31st year and somehow get a different result. We're not going to take $60 billion of our taxpayers' money and give it to the insurance companies, and this bill is not worth doing, and it should be voted down if there's no public option. And I don't mean a trigger public option. There's a section of the book about fake public options. And I don't mean a co-op public option. We tried a co-op before. It was called Blue Cross. I suspect the one here, just like most of them, are now private insurance companies who stick it to you just like every other private insurance company sticks it to you. So we don't want any of this hocus pocus about co-ops. I love Kent Conrad. He's a wonderful guy, but he's wrong on this, and we ought not to vote for that nonsense, because that is a political compromise, not a policy, and a political compromise is rarely make good policy. So I think I've said about as much as I'm going to about the book. I can go on for 3 or 4 hours, and we could have a great time. But let's talk about exactly the parts of the book or parts of healthcare that you'd like to talk about. And I'm not going to pick the questioners, which gets me out of a lot of trouble. But we have some people with microphones, and if you raise your hand, you will have a microphone in front of you in short order.
Yes, lady in the blue right here.
Why isn't the government framing this the way you have?
Well, I think the president himself understands that if you don't have a public option, this doesn't work. But there are a lot of political people that are involved in this, and some of them think that politics is a good thing. And some of them make the case, which is absolutely wrong, and we're going to pay a big price for it in 2010 in the elections if this view prevails, that any bill that gets in the front of the president can be called a victory. That is a very foolish, short-sighted approach to take, and I hope that's not the view that prevails. But remember, four-fifths of the Democrats in the House and over two-thirds of them in the Senate want a public option. I think we're going to get a public option. I really do. This is kind of the low point where we've got to deal with the Finance Committee, and we're going to deal with it, and it won't, a public option won't come out of there. But, you know, there's an awful lot of Democrats that know very well that a very large portion of their base is going to sit at home in 2010 if they don't come up with a public option. And they're mindful of that. I've talked to a lot of them. And so I do think there's a very good chance we're going to get a bill by December that the president will sign with a public option in it.
Next question. Right here in the red.
First of all, I'd just like to thank you for the 60-seat majority in the Senate. It's wonderful to see that again. Thank you. It's my father's a union side labor lawyer, so to be able to sit here knowing that once healthcare gets out of the way, we're going to get an Employee Free Choice Act through Congress is something that I didn't think I would see any time in short order. So thank you. I'm from Chicago, and the district just north of me is where Congressman Mark Kirk serves. And by his own platform, by his own policy statements, he's a very moderate guy, you know, left-leaning on some things, conservative-leaning on some things. We'll probably make a good next junior senator of Illinois. But one of the things that always surprised me about him was the fact that even though he's so moderate, if George W. Bush needed another Republican vote, you could call Mark Kirk, and by God, Mark Kirk was going to stand with his party. He was going to vote when his party needed him. And what I don't understand is why can't the Democrats do that right now? Why can't we? If the Republicans can rally, can circle the wagons right now around arguments that are just not true, why can't we get people? Why can't we get the wagons rounded up around what's actually happening?
Well, thanks for leading with the easy ones. Look, one of the curses of being a Democrat is that you actually have to live with thoughtful, independent-minded people. And it's just the way we are. It is maddening. You wish we could be disciplined as the Republicans. Even though we're in the majority, we're still not that way. It's kind of actually, if you didn't have to go to war every day with the Republicans, it'd be more fun to live the way we do. We actually have ideas that we exchange and thoughtfulness, and truth is a value that matters more than just winning all the time. But the problem is truth is the value that matters more than winning. People are actually entitled to believe that the public option won't work, although I suspect that that sentiment is directly proportional to how much money they take from the health insurance industry if you look at who gets what. We are a little freer about the exchange of ideas. It's what we think is great about this country, and that we really do believe in the freedoms that we have in this country, unlike the Republicans, who I sometimes think only believe in their own freedoms and not anybody else's. And so it makes it much tougher. I mean, it was, you know, being the DNC chair was a real exercise in delight some days, trying to figure out how you're going to get everybody on the same page. But, you know, I don't think you're going to fundamentally change the nature of who we are. We are different than Republicans in that way. We do value those kinds of abilities to be different. The one area where I think there should be no tolerance whatsoever is, and this has been in every legislative body, including Congress, that I've known anything about, is that there ought not to be independence from party on procedural votes. I expect everyone who caucuses with the Democrats to vote for cloture. If we have 60 people who caucus with the Democrats at the time of that vote, I expect them all to vote for it. And if they don't vote for it, then they ought not to be chairs of committees or anything else like that. That's the whole purpose of doing it. I supported Joe Lieberman getting his chair back after how awful he was to the Democrats during the campaign. The reason I supported that is just for this moment. If you take a chairmanship from the Democratic Party, you don't owe us a vote on a particular substantive issue. That's your business. But you owe the leader who made you the chair the support when he asked for a procedural vote. And that's a universal rule in every legislative body. And if you don't want to do that, then you have to leave the party. And with it, your chairmanship.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a lot of hands, so please keep your questions succinct.
Yeah, and I'll try to keep my answers brief because that's a bigger problem than the questions.
Right here in the black.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dean. What did you call the public option in Vermont? And secondly, what Are you able to do some arm twisting and talk to the senators and the congressmen and your Democratic fellow colleagues to twist their arm a little bit?
Well, we call the public option in Vermont Dr. Dinosaur because it was sort of kid-friendly. And it was actually started by one of my predecessors, Governor Madeline Cunin, who aimed it at small children and pregnant mothers. And what we did is took it and expanded it to become more of a universal health care program. But the name stuck. And, frankly, people don't want to think they're on Medicaid because that's associated with poor people. And this was really a middle-class program. My strong advocacy is to use Medicare as the public option. And there's a political reason for this. First of all, I think that if you don't have something in place by the 2010 election, people are still going to be saying all these crazy things about death panels and who knows what else, rationing, et cetera, et cetera, and there's going to be nothing to refute them. But if you have this in place by 2010, then I think people will see that this is a great thing for 55-year-old steelworkers who have been laid off and can't find employment and still can get some insurance, et cetera, et cetera. And the only way you can do that is use Medicare, because Medicare is already up and running. If you try to create a new bureaucracy to deal with this, I think you've got a big problem. So I would use Medicare. And Medicare, of course, is not a poor person's program. You can call it Medicare, and that'll be fine. So what was the second part of the question? Oh, how can I arm twist? I don't really arm twist, and I'm not in a position to arm twist. What I do is call people up and make the case like I did to you. I've actually had some very good conversations with Arlen Specter about this, and he's a very bright guy, and he gets that there's a big advantage to have something up and running by the time his election takes place. So there's a lot of people in that. Dodd is another one who's been very good about the public option because he has to run for re-election, and he knows that he's going to need the very large base of the Democratic Party. You know, the press, of course, is always the second to last people know out before the United States Senate about what's going on anywhere. But the press keeps calling this the left that wants the public option. The vast majority of Democrats want a public option. Actually, I think a majority of Democrats want a single payer, and this is the compromise. So, if we can't have a public option, it's not just the left you're going to make mad. It's the majority of the Democratic Party, which happens to be the majority of people that are going to elect Chris Dodd or re-elect Chris Dodd. And so that, you just remind people of that. You don't have to twist their arms. And there are a lot of groups that are working very hard on this. There's a wonderful alliance called HCAN, which has got about 200 members of it. And I work part-time for a group called Democracy for America, which is the remnants of my campaign still going, and a lot of the unions are in it, and all kinds of physician groups. And we remind people all the time that this is what people really want. The majority of Republicans in this country believe there should be a public option. They wouldn't sign up for it, but they believe they ought to have the choice. This is really about personal choice, and Americans are really big on personal choice. And I think that, that's the argument that we use. This is not about whether you like the insurance companies or not. It's about whether you're going to vote for your constituents or whether you're going to vote against your constituents, because your constituents want the choice.
Next question, right here, and then we'll work our way back.
We should not discriminate against the back of the room.
Can you refute the idea that the public option is going to put private insurance out of business? As I understand it, there will be a penalty for employers who drop their coverage. But what the Republicans say is that penalty will be worth it to the employer. People will then switch to the public option, and private insurers will go out of business. So can you refute that?
Very interesting thing. Of course, the Republicans don't know what they're talking about. It's not a surprise. Well, it's true. I don't mean to be mean. I don't mean Republican voters. I think, but I mean the people who are saying things like that. This is a really interesting thing. I do a lot of public speaking, and I was invited to go speak to something called the Business Council, which is the CEOs of the 750 largest companies in America. They had done a poll the night before I got there, which they'd left in my briefing package to get ready for the next day's panels and speeches and stuff that I was doing. 96% of the leaders of the biggest companies in America favor retaining the employer-based system, even though they know it's expensive. And I'm thinking to myself, why is this? And one of the reasons is that they want the competitive edge that it gives them. For those of you who run your own small business or small businesses, one of the hard things is that at will, somebody can come in and take one of your employees and say, well, boy, we're going to give you a benefit package that you're going to like. And it does serve them to do that. And the other interesting thing is about, I'm not big on the private insurance world for good reason. But we shouldn't overlook the fact that the private sector has created a lot of innovation that the government has not created. And one of the most, some of the most innovative people in healthcare financing are self-insured large corporations who have to pay the bills. General Electric and Microsoft and probably the University of Pennsylvania, for all, I'm guessing, et cetera, have good benefit packages. If they're self-insured, a lot of them start stressing wellness. You know, one of the things that's not being debated in Congress, which is probably save us more money than anything else, is we could only switch this system from an illness-based system to a wellness-based system. And the people who have come the farthest in that are actually these big self-insured corporations. They have done, you know, gotten all the lousy food out of their cafeteria. They give people free memberships. Some of them even send people a check and see if you've actually shown up in the healthcare club that they give you the free membership to. So, you know, there's room for everybody in here. The only other thing I'd say about that myth is there is no system that I'm aware of in the Western industrial world that doesn't have some private health insurance. I'd say Britain is probably the most socialized system in the Western democratic world. 15% of all the dollars in the public health system in Great Britain are private dollars, and it goes up into the 40s in the Netherlands and places like that. So there isn't going to be the health insurance companies are not going to go out of business. The health insurance companies, some will, because they won't adapt. What we're going to present the health insurance companies with if a public option passes is what I said earlier. A system which you can't be refused health insurance, you can't be kicked off your health insurance if you get sick, you can take it anywhere you want in the country, and the rates you pay are the same whether you're healthy or sick. But that's what they're going to have to do in order to keep their business. I think that's a great thing. That'll make health insurance, that'll make the private companies better, and everybody would be the winner. There's also another piece of this. If you sign up for the public system and you discover it's too bureaucratic or it's one size fits all or all the things that the Republicans said about Medicare are right, fine, you can get out of it. You can take your government subsidy if you don't have much money and you need one and take it to the private sector and get one of their health care packages. This is a great idea to do it this way. And ultimately, if the insurance system doesn't get their act together, we will end up in a single payer. But I don't think we're ever going to get a pure single payer because even the single payer countries don't have pure single payers.
Let's keep on moving. Lady in the yellow there with her hand up. It's fine. Then we'll come forward.
I have a question for you. What happens when the public option pays a lesser fee and doctors step out of the, I'll say, Medicare system and just start accepting private pay? And you have possibly the better doctors who aren't part of the participating in the government system. How do you manage that?
Well, there's two parts of your question. The first is the primary care issue, which we had to deal with when we did this 15 years ago in Vermont for kids. And you have to raise the Medicare rates for primary care physicians. You have to do it. The second is a broader question. And this is actually speaking of private sector. Massachusetts, as you know, has this extraordinary experiment going on. And the great news about it is their uninsured rate is 2.5%. That's comparable to a lot of places in Europe. They're only using private health insurance. The downside is, of course, that they're going broke, partly because of the recession and partly because there's no cost controls of any kind and they don't have a public option. So they had a big conclave, including doctors and hospitals and all the medical industrial complex. This drives me nuts about the press because the press only writes about fighting and Baucus and hates the single-payer people and the single-payer people hate Baucus and somebody said something catty. This is an incredible story. The medical people in the state of Massachusetts voted to get rid of fee-for-service medicine this summer, and nobody noticed. Fee-for-service medicine is not a good thing because it pays us to do things we don't need to do. And interestingly, most doctors who do what I did for a living, which is a primary care, would love to be on a salary. And the reason is that the average primary care physician in the United States of America, which spends 70% more than as a percent of GNP, a system which spends 70% more as a percent of GNP gets paid less than a primary care physician on salary working for the National Health Service in Britain. We would love to be on salary so we could see a patient every 15 minutes instead of every 6 minutes, which the HMO wants us to do. We would love to be on salary so we could actually practice medicine the way we were trained to practice medicine and listen to patients and think about what we were doing. Now, at the top end, that's not true. If you're a cardiac surgeon or you do a lot of procedures, you'd like to get paid by the procedure because you get paid a lot more, and that's a problem. But, first of all, there is almost no correlation whatsoever with what you make as a doctor and how good you are. That is a fact. And if you don't believe me, Atul Gawande, who's one of the most prominent public health physicians in the country, had a great article in The New Yorker on July 1st of this year, which is just one of the best pieces, probably one of the 10 very best pieces I've read in 30 years. And he talked, I won't go through the whole thing, but basically he looked at different charges. It turns out that McAllen, Texas, in the south, very poor part of southern Texas, has Medicare expenditures that are three times the average for the rest of the country. And you know who has among the lowest expenses in the country? The Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. So I leave you to think about which may be the better doctors, the ones in McAllen, Texas, and the ones in the Mayo Clinic. But what you pay is not necessarily related to how good your medicine is. That is a myth. Unfortunately, and this is a very complicated problem, and it's a, you know, bedside manner has more to do with what your doctor, what your patient thinks about what kind of a doctor you are than how good the patient is. And so having a lousy bedside manner doesn't mean you're a great doctor. But having a good bedside manner doesn't mean you are either, although in my specialty it helps a lot because there are some specialties like internal medicine, pediatrics particularly, and psychiatry where it's nice to have a bedside manner.
We'll go to the gentleman here.
Thank you.
Dr. Dean, I appreciate the fact that the Democratic Party is comprised of a bunch of free thinkers, which is terrific. But after they painted Max Cleland as a traitor, after they suggested that Senator McCain had fathered a black child illegitimately, after the Swift voting, after what happened to you and your so-called scream, how could you possibly be surprised by death panels? how is it that the Democratic Party is always caught flat-footed with the jaw dropping at what happens?
Well, this is a very interesting and very complicated question, but the news is mostly good on this question. The truth is that we don't really want to live in a society dominated by people who do those things. And the good news is people under 35 are totally unaffected by that crap. This is an amazing thing. This has nothing to do with health. Well, it has peripheral to do with health care. Barack Obama was elected by people under 35. This is the first election in my life, in anybody's lifetime in this room, where more people under 35 voted who voted than were over 35. And this new generation, even though their values are very similar to ours in many ways, and they're much more socially progressive, for example, than the Republican Party, especially, and much more tolerant, because this is the first multicultural generation in the history of America. Now, of course, this has been a multicultural country for 400 years, but this is the first generation where people have grown up with people that are significantly different than they are, and they value them as people first rather than some representative of some group. And, of course, the first thing they did was elect a multicultural president. That they have slammed the door on the anger technique of the Republicans for the last 30 years. They are, and it's, I debate Karl Rove a lot as part of my shtick. And it is, you know, it's funny, after I debate him, I get all these emails from my supporters saying, how come you didn't rip his lungs out? What's the matter with you? Are you having a bad day? The reason I don't do it is because young people don't want to hear about that anymore. And the more you do it, the more you lose. You know why these town meetings have been, these town meetings are not about health care, because the people who go there don't know anything about health care. And they are willfully misinformed. And you tell them what the truth is, and they don't want to hear it. This is about anger. This is about fury. This is a group of people who now no longer elect presidents. And they're not going to elect a president for a long, long time, because the next presidential election, this under 35 group is going to be under 39, and then they're going to be under 43. And guess what? The new paradigm in this country is stop fighting and start getting something done about the things we care about. And we'll work with anybody. It's true. So I guess the answer that I'm saying is, you know, we had to wait 30 years before the clock came around so that there's a standard of decency and honesty in public discourse again in this country. But the new generation has got it. It's going to be of value. And until the Republicans learn to do it, they're not going to win a lot of elections. They'll win some in 2010 because there's a natural bounce back. And if we don't pass health care, they'll win a lot more than they should. But they're going to have to learn that the kind of stuff they've done for the last 30 years is not the way to motivate the younger generation. So maybe, you know, I'm always an advocate of, you know, taking it right to them and sticking it to them. But Barack Obama was an advocate of let's all try to get along. And he's a tough guy. And I think he's from Chicago, like some other people here. And he gets what he has to do in the end of the day. But at the end of the day, I think the kids were right and I was wrong. When I came back off the campaign trail, my teenagers, in the course of a variety of discussions I had, just said, well, Dad, you're just too confrontational. Well, you have to have teenagers to appreciate how outrageous to be told by your teenage kids. But it was true. Our whole generation was about confrontation. And we each escalated. This new generation's not about that. So that's some good news. The good news is they're going to be temperamentally much more inclined toward us. The bad news is, while they're very socially progressive, they're also fiscally conservative, and we better watch our deficit package before. Otherwise, that's the one way. The only way the Republicans get them back is to cut out all the gay bashing and the race baiting and all that other stuff and start talking about money, and that's their only chance. But I think the Republicans aren't ready to do that for a while because their base just loves being angry.
Let's keep going here. Lady in the yellow about six rows back, and then there was a lady with a hand up all the way in back red.
You just brought up money. And so I'd like to know, can you explain where the economies are going to come from in Medicare, for instance?
Yes, great question. Thank you. Because that's actually, of course, politics being what it is. When the Republicans wanted to cut Medicare, it was all waste, fraud, and abuse. But now that we want to take advantage of the waste, fraud, and abuse to help pay for part of the health care package, now it's stealing from seniors. In fact, so let me tell you where the cuts are going to come from, because you're going to need to know this as you go out and hear about this from your community if you're a senior. Here's where the cuts come from in Medicare. One is insurance companies get a 20% premium for doing Medicare Part D, which we could do for nothing additional. So we're going to reduce that premium. That comes out of the insurance companies. Two is medical equipment. I happen to have a 90-year-old mother-in-law who needs a lot of help. And we discovered in the process of trying to get her some help that we could go buy a wheelchair out of our own pocket for $300. But if we did it through Medicare, the medical equipment person got $1,200. And that's pretty standard. As some of you all in here have bought canes and this and that and the other thing on Medicare. Well, if you go out and buy it yourself, it's just, I mean, so there's a big chunk of money that comes out of that. And so the money is not coming from cutting benefits to seniors. It's just not true. The money comes from cutting all the stuff that's wasteful spending, the stuff that's been stuck in there for year after year for lobbyists that benefit hospitals, insurance companies, and medical suppliers. But it's not coming from any, I'm aware of, not one single benefit is going to be taken away from any senior in order to make the savings that are necessary to do this.
There's a lady in red right here, a couple of rows down.
I do believe Medicare is good and great, and I'm happy for everything, but can you please explain to me why I need Medigap insurance? And will that change?
It won't change, and here's why you need it. Medicare was never designed to be a comprehensive policy that covered everything everybody wanted. It was designed to be a safety net, same way Social Security was. You know, Social Security was not designed. This is why I was so adamantly opposed to privatizing Social Security. Social Security was being designed to be a safety net so old people wouldn't starve, which is what they were doing during the Depression. And so older folks used to be the poorest people in America. And now because of Medicare and Social Security, they're not anymore. Unfortunately, the poorest people in America are now children. But so, and I actually favor this model of Medicare. I don't think this country can't afford to give comprehensive we'll cover everything policies to everybody, because, of course, the number of seniors is going to go up and the number of people supporting the program is going to go down over the years. And if we expand Medicare, it gets, well, even though you bring some more people in who are actually paying cash, which helps, you've got a bigger thing. So the reason people need Medigap is to make up the difference between a really decent health care policy and one that is a bare-bones safety net policy. It's the same reason people need 401ks. 401ks and retirement plans are the difference between being able to eke it out and not starve under Social Security. Because people who live just on Social Security, that is a tough existence. They don't die, and they have a roof over their head, and they have food. But, you know, it's tough. So I actually am not opposed to this. If I were running for office, I would promise you we'd fix it so nobody would ever have to put another nickel in Medicare again. But that's fiscally not responsible, and that's why I think the system is okay the way it is. And for very poor people, they're actually, who are older, they actually, instead of Medigap, they're also become eligible for Medicaid, which is a full comprehensive program because it's designed for poor folks.
Lady in the second row in the black.
I have to raise some questions about the issue that you're just discussing. I happen to be, I have a chronic illness. I've been on SSDI for a long time. As a result of that, I'm broke because SSDI is just not enough to live on for a long time if you're not already have saved up money. So if you get ill in this society early on in life and your SSDI and SSA are low because you haven't accumulated all those points or whatever it is, you cannot live on that income. I'm now being forced to drop my Medigap. Medicare, I don't know what I'd do without it, but there are doctors who won't take it. There are lab tests that I need that I absolutely can't get because they're not covered. So I think that if Medicare, without going through the litany, I think if Medicare is looked at a little bit more critically, if we're going to model a system on Medicare, we've got to do that because it's not true that people are okay on Medicare and on Social Security. I mean, it's just not true. And I'd love a really good study done on it. People are impoverished. I'm trying to get food stamps, and I'm having a hard time. I mean, that's not a way to live in this country after you've worked hard and educated yourself and stuff. So even though you say it's fiscally irresponsible, where are we going to get the money if people don't pay some part of it? Then it's not. Then something else has to be figured out by the smarter economists and health economists and such. Because it
Governor
hurts.
Dean, would you like to respond, Miss? We've got to move on to other questions.
The issue you raise is a very good one, and it's one that I was speaking at the University of Tennessee yesterday, and this came up as well. But the issue is not that the system doesn't work. The system works really well. It just doesn't work well for everybody. And it doesn't work terribly well for people on SSDI, which is a tiny fraction of the number of people on Medicare. So I would say the answer to your question is not to abandon Medicare as a model for how to do the public option, but it's to look at the places where Medicare is inadequate. There's another place that Medicare is inadequate, the so-called donut hole for prescription. Now, that actually is going to get fixed in this legislation. There's some of the money that is taken away from the insurance companies that their returns with supplying drugs is going to be used to plug the donut hole. So that's one thing that can fix that. I don't know enough about SSDI to answer your question about how it should be fixed, but clearly it does need to be fixed. And I had another person with a very similar situation to yours at a signing I did yesterday at Tennessee that had almost exactly the same story. And so, you know, you've got to fix that. That's not expensive because there are not a lot of people on SSDI relative to the 50 million people that are on Medicare. But it is a systemic problem and has to be fixed.
A few more questions. Gentleman in the black here.
I'm curious to know your position or opinion about tort reform. A friend of mine's an ophthalmologist and is ceasing doing surgery because of $170,000 malpractice insurance policy, so she's just not doing surgery anymore. Many people say that the Democrats are in the pocket of the trial lawyers. I don't know if that's true or not, but what is your feeling about how important tort reform is to this medical bill? Thank you.
It's very complicated. So let me start by saying this. Tort reform, or the torts matter because they create an atmosphere of pain, of defensive medicine. But they are over-exaggerated, the effects. So, but they matter. It's not irrelevant. So here's some of the problems. The first problem is this is not a federal issue. Most of the malpractice torts don't get filed in federal court unless they're a class action. They get filed in the state courts. So I don't mean to dismiss this. I'm a physician, right? But from a constitutional point of view, I don't see how the Congress can alter state constitutions. If the Constitution in some state says you have a right to this and a right to that, then in that state, when you get sued in state court, that's what governs. So the Republicans have always made this empty promise about we're going to do tort reform at the federal level. Well, fine. That's going to save 2% of the cases. And there are some – now, the other problem with tort reform is it's possible to be too draconian. There are – you know, if you have – there are caps that basically if you get sick, you have no recourse. There are torts for a good reason. If somebody is harmed by a physician or a hospital or somebody, they ought to be – there ought to be some recompense for that, for negligence. On the other hand, here's what the really big problem is, and ophthalmology is actually one I should add to my list. In some cases, like Vermont, the premiums are very low. In Tennessee, I talked to a pediatrician yesterday whose premiums as a pediatrician were three times higher than my wife's, who's an internist, in Vermont. So it varies enormously from state to state. So I would say, but the one commonality is that in almost in every state that I know of, the malpractice premiums are completely out of control for obstetricians, anesthesiologists, and neurosurgeons, and maybe I should add ophthalmological surgeons, although one could argue they were neurosurgeons. That does have to be dealt with. Now, there are a lot of ways you could do it, and one of the things I've tried out on people, and the doctors don't like it, and the trial lawyers don't like it, so it probably has some merit to it, is this idea of, in some cases, having arbitration required before. And you can't deny someone a jury trial in this country if they want one. And so you do the arbitration, but then here's the controversial part, especially for the lawyers. You allow the arbitrator's verdict to be entered as evidence if there's a trial. That at least introduces some rationality, and it doesn't deprive the patient of what they're owed because of possible potential negligence and so forth and so on. It also weeds out frivolous claims. Although the interesting thing about this is the really good lawyers who make a lot of money in torts don't take frivolous cases. And I know that for a fact because I was threatened with a lawsuit one time and we were able to produce a piece of paper that showed the patient wasn't telling the truth. And when we took it to the doctor, the lawyer, who was a very, actually, although he practices in Vermont, he had done some national major cases, he just said, I don't take patients like this, so they'll have to go someplace else. And that was the end of it. The ones you have to worry about are the ones that are hand-to-mouth, just starting their practice and desperate and hoping that, you know, those are the ones that cause the frivolous lawsuits, if there are some. And there are frivolous lawsuits. So it is incredibly complicated. It's a good idea to do some tort reform. It is a bad idea to think that the federal government can do it, whether you put the Republicans in place. And here's the political aspect of it. The political aspect of it is it's not in the bill. It's not in the bill for two reasons. The first is, if you're going to do a big bill like this, you're going to make a lot of people mad who have a lot of money and are very powerful. And why should we just add another group like tort lawyers onto that? And the other is, we wouldn't get one single extra vote if we did do tort reform at the federal level from any Republican because they're not interested in helping us pass the bill. They're going to kill the bill no matter what we put in it. So why should we screw up a perfectly good bill by adding something like that, which is very complicated, probably doesn't have a lot of benefit from a federal intervention because of the nature of where torts are filed, and that's why it's not in the bill. Your question is an incredibly good one. It requires a very thoughtful, comprehensive debate. Probably this is not the right place for it, was my argument.
Folks, we're on a tight schedule. There are a lot of questions. We have to end it here. Please join me in thanking Governor Dean.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.